Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at dunbarlumber.com. I want to talk about the Canucks blue line here in a little bit, but let's run through some more of these individual season totals for the Canucks. We did Pettersson, 90.5, Miller, 90.5. You like the over on PD, the under on Miller, and we did Sprong at 34.5, which certainly after last night looks like
a
very interesting over. So back to the top end of the lineup, Quinn Hughes, 84.5. Oof. Pretty big number for a defenseman. Over a point per game, 84.5 for Quinn Hughes.
I think you got to go under just off of the, like, 84.5. So the career points for Quinn Hughes, right? 53 in 68 games. So let's call that 60, low 60s. Mm-hmm. 41 in 56 games. Let's call that mid 60s. 68 in 76 games. That's high 60s.
Let's call that high 60s.
76 in 78 games. And call
that high 70s.
And 92 in 82 games. Personal shooting percentage spiked to 8.5. He'd never previously been above 6.3 in his NHL career. 5.9 for his career. I think some of that is probably going to prove to be sustainable. Like, I think he'll have some gains as a shooter, given mm-hmm. some of what he's figured out and how thoughtful he is about how he works on it. On ice shooting percentage last year was 12 for his career, full season. So from 1920 on, 9.8, 8, 11.3, 12. Okay. I never want to bet against Quinn Hughes, ever.
That's the sticking point.
Ever. So this would be a stay away for me, but if I, a gun to my head, I'm taking the under.
Yeah, that is the sticking point for me too, right? Because you see an over point per game prop for a defenseman, right? And it's like, oh boy, man, that's just so hard to do. And if he's even out, if he misses five games, all of a sudden it becomes like really, really tough to do.
It's also just such a high bar. Like,
that's the thing.
84 points for a defenseman is wild stuff. Now, I mean, it happens obviously, but like, you know, that's elite production that he has to hit on a regular basis, right? For, you know, the sake of context, 84 point seasons, 84 point individual seasons in the last decade, there's seven of them.
Yeah.
Seven. He has to hit an outlier of one of the seven best offensive seasons of the last 10 years. Carlson, by the way, had the 100 point season. Josi, the year he won the Norris, had 96. Quinn Hughes had 92 last year, then Makar at 90. Makar had another one at 86. Josi had another one at 85. Hedman at 85. I've been thinking about this. Do you mind if I squirrel the conversation briefly? I've been thinking about this. Like, so I'm going to put together my breakout tiers. It's an exercise I go through every year over at The Athletic. And, you know, there are many different types of breakouts. When we talk about breakout, we're usually talking about like what Nils Höglander had last year, and yet his role didn't really expand. Mm-hmm. So for me, in some ways, that's like an ephemeral breakout. I'm more looking at like your Joshua type thing, where like, to me, that's a more substantive breakout, where it's like guy goes from being a fringe NHL roster guy, you know, and granted, like, he was never going to be waived because of his unique profile. But, you know, we came into the season, if you'd said things like, you know, I think Joshua should be a fixture on the third line, you'd have people disagree with mm-hmm. not everybody, but some people. What?
You could even imagine a world where it's like he's getting healthy scratched regularly, 100%. Right? If his development goes the other way.
Absolutely. And instead you end, you know, the season and he's playing top 6 minutes in the playoffs,
yeah,
and, you know, is like leaving money on the table to sign 3x4 in Vancouver. And then it's like, wow, he left a lot of money. Like, what are we, you know, that's a breakout to me in of a different magnitude. But there's also like for Atu Ratu, a breakout doesn't necessarily mean this year that he like is an 18 goal, 18 assist guy and plays top 9 minutes. It's like you can break out and become full-time NHL player. That to me is kind of a breakout, right? What happened to Quinn Hughes last year, where you go from being one of the best defensemen in the world to being the Norris Trophy winner. That to me is a breakout. And I actually think there's like what JT Miller, JT Miller becoming this high end defensive center. That's a breakout at the age of 30.
Yeah.
Anyway, lots to get into there. Well, and we'll spend a lot of time on it, I'm sure, before the season begins. But with Hughes, I still think there's actually room for another breakout campaign. And I say that while still fading the 84 points thing. And I think when you think about it thematically, when you think about the opportunity ahead of Quinn Hughes here, what's the next level? Well, the next level is Quinn Hughes has established himself now as you know, a top five defenseman in the league. Not a lot of argument in hockey circles about it, where there was last year, the old 3B thing. Now, if you tell people that Quinn Hughes is the best defenseman in the world, bar none, not had the best season of any defenseman in the world last year, because that's just true, they won the Norris, but is the best defenseman in the world, people will say Cale Makar. No, it's Cale Makar. The majority of people. There's some people who will disagree, but we're going into this campaign, and I think there's a couple of sort of things to watch, because I do think that like next tier of breakout that like is accepted as the best defenseman in the world edges out Cale Makar, makes it sort of clear. I actually think that's somewhat in play, and it's not going to be easy because, again, and I've talked about this before, there are physical advantages that Cale Makar has over Quinn Hughes. Quinn Hughes is never going to be Cale Makar's size, right? He's never going to be able to hit like Cale Makar. And Cale Makar's a right-handed shooter who happens to be probably the single best shot maker on the blue line in the league. And even though Hughes scored 17 goals, like there's a difference in the caliber of their shot.
Yep.
Period. Right? But last year, anyway, Cale Makar didn't really drive play the way he usually has, right? Like him and MacKinnon get used as a five-man unit, and in minutes when Makar was away from MacKinnon, the results looked massively different. Well, that doesn't really happen with Hughes, right? Hughes was often used as a five-man unit with JT Miller, but guess what happens when Quinn Hughes is on the ice without JT Miller? The Canucks dominate play, right? Like Hughes is the primary engine that drives the Canucks at 5-on-5. MacKinnon is the primary engine that drives the Avalanche at 5-on-5, not Cale Makar. In previous years, though, Makar's, from an underlying perspective, when you watch the games, like Makar's two-way impact was elite. Last year, kind of wasn't. If the Canucks continue to have the level of team success they did last season, if they finish ahead of the Avs in the standings, if Quinn Hughes remains the primary driver of what Vancouver does at 5-on-5, and Cale Makar's two-way form doesn't bounce back next season, I think that does switch the argument a bit. But more than that, you've got a couple of pretty interesting possibilities for head-to-heads.
Well, the Four Nations.
The Four Nations is the big one.
If we're just talking, separate this from the Canucks season and just talk about like reputational battles.
Yeah.
I mean, best on best, that's a huge opportunity to stake your claim to being the best defenseman in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you're going to have, you know, Hughes and Fox versus Makar and Taves probably as top pairs. It's going to be sick. By the way, it's going to be fun when they put Hughes with Fox and everyone will see who drives on that pair. That's going to be an interesting one. That might be the death knell for the PSYOP. But anyway, if Hughes is the best defenseman at that tournament, right? If the Canucks are in the same tier as the Avs and Hughes's impact in Vancouver remains larger than Makar's, if they have a chance to meet in the playoffs, I'm just saying I'm not even predicting that it'll happen, but it's in play, I think, for Hughes to elevate even further in terms of the discourse around the best blue liner on the planet.
And the next part of that as well, if he's into that conversation, right, or if he even does find a way to kind of jump over Cale Makar, the next part of the discussion for Quinn Hughes is also like how close to the top five in the league conversation can you get, right? And then that's a tough group to crack with McDavid and Matthews and MacKinnon and all that, at least as a top three, Kucherov, et cetera. You go down the list. But I mean, if you establish yourself as the best defenseman in the league and you have another season comparable to what he did last year, then I think you do start to put yourself at least close to that conversation.
Yeah. And I guess the other part of this, too, is it's fair to say that Hughes wasn't as dominant in the playoffs as he had been in the regular season. I don't think he was poor by any means. He was still Quinn Hughes. But, you know, he wasn't like playing 30 minutes a night the way we expected.
It wasn't like a signature performance that can elevate you in the way some playoff performances do.
It looked like the Nashville Predators got to him a bit on the forecheck, right? Like, I'm just saying he wasn't at the same dominant level that he was throughout the regular season. What do you want to bet that it's a little different when they make it next time? You know, like, I bet it's going to be a little different. So that's the other part of this, too, where I think Hughes can hit sort of another tier in that conversation. You want to do another one?
Yeah. Let's go. Well, I was going to say lightning round, but I think that might be futile.
Well, also, it's more fun to like get into
the
weeds.
I know. All right. Besser, 62.5.
62.5 for Besser?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I think you'd take the over in a contract year on that.
He was at 73 last year. And the thing is, like, we're talking point totals because sometimes so he had 40 goals and 33 assists.
Yeah.
Sometimes what you see with the shooting percentage regression guys is, okay, that shot that went off the post and went in for you, it goes off the post and then falls into the crease and then one of your teammates bangs it home, right? So you don't get a goal, but you get an assist. And so, like, I wouldn't be surprised if he has, like, 30 goals but 40 assists next year, right? Where, like, some of it is the shooting regression is offset by, you know, you're picking up more of those random assists around the net.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key with Besser is because he's now a fixture again on power play one, right? I think this is a bet where you can believe that you're betting the base rate by taking the over. And mm-hmm. sort of what I'd point to is, you know, the last time he was unquestioned on PP1, like, it was a long time ago. Like, it was like 2017-18 when he was playing it with the Twins. Because you think about it, like, by the next couple of years, so I guess it was two seasons later, 18-19, he was a fixture on PP1. By the next year, you've got, like, Toffoli takes his spot.
Yeah.
You know, he gets injured and kind of loses his spot on PP1. I mean, he played it pretty regularly in 2020-2021, but, you know, then there's the Kuzmenko thing and on, right? Like, he just, remember Alex Chason? Mm-hmm. He had a lot of Alex Chason on PP1, on and on. He was good at it, by the way. I just want to defend Alex Chason while noting it. He had 25 power play points last year. And yeah, he shot 19.6%. There's a ton of regression risk in Besser's profile, as there is for just about every single top Canucks player last season. But I guess the other thing is he never hit that 63.5 total in any year before last year. But even that's deceptive because Besser battled durability issues as a young player for a variety of reasons.
And two of those years were shortened by the pandemic to various degrees.
100%. But it's like that 17-18, like his rookie year, it looks like 55 points when you check it on the back of a hockey card, but per 82 games, it's 73, right? The pandemic shortened years are perfect examples too, where, you know, he only plays the 57 games, has 45 points. Well, you're going to flirt with 63 over 82 in that season. The next year, 49 points in 56 games, you're smashing 63. And then here's the other part. Like, as much as injuries were part of the conversation around Brock Besser in previous years, you know, this is a player who's missed 20 games the last three seasons, right? Less than seven mm-hmm. a year. This is a player who's found some durability here. And I would add too, it was never like he had repetitive soft tissue injuries or anything. Like, it was always just like insane bad luck that seemed to afflict him.
Played every game in the North Division season as well. So Right. Even you stretch it back 4 years, right? Like, he has not missed a lot of time on a per season basis.
Yeah. Yeah, so 20 divided by 4, 5 games a year.
Yeah.
And even last year, the game that he missed was the one where they rest everyone in game 82. So I like betting on durability on Besser, and I like betting that the base rate for him with a full-time PP1 role is a lot higher than 63.5.
All right, Jake DeBrusque, 48.5.
Oh, man.
So much of it, like, this is a classic one. Do you think he's going to stick on the power play or not?
That's a pure stay away. I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. He will smash that if he's the fifth or the fourth forward, the fifth man on PP1. He will miss on that if he is not. It's really that simple. Like, if you have 35 to 40 5-on-5 points, you're elite. Like, that's so, so hard to do. I think people struggle with sort of understanding that. Like, for example, think about how dominant JT Miller was 5-on-5 last year. 48 points.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you're not on PP1, if you can't count on getting the five or six, like, the power play one, 20 plus extra points from being on power play one. If you're only getting the four or five from PP2, and then maybe you get a few empty netters. Like, that's the other thing with Besser, right? Besser's out late,
yep,
and scored a ton of empty netters last year. Like, that's going to help him hit that 63-5. I'd imagine DeBrusque is going to be similarly entrusted over the course of the season.
And then for guys like Miller and Pedersen, you throw in, like, the overtime points and stuff as well. Like, totally. You know what I mean? Yeah, where you're going to get those opportunities. Yeah,
DeBrusque will have those. So 47.5. I mean, I think if you're not on power play one and you're sort of pegging him in for 7 or 8 power play points, you're assuming, like, let's say 3 empty net goals, you know, it gets hard. Like, even with that, we're talking about 45-on-5 points. That's a ton of production at even strength. You know, for context, Jake DeBrusque's career high 5-on-5 points is 34, right? So you're counting on a career matching his career high or exceeding his career high here, plus playing power play one if you're betting the over. So even though 47.5 seems low, I actually think it involves a little bit too much projection for me to recommend the over. I think I'd lean under, but that's a pure stay away because I just don't know what role he has, and I'm a little nervous about it with Daniel Sprong in town.
Connor Garland, 45.5.
I mean, I think that's an over. My gut reaction is that that's an over. 43.5?
45.5.
45. He hasn't been lower than that in his three seasons in Vancouver.
And on a point per game basis, I mean, even the year before he came, he had 39 and 49 for Arizona, right?
But
and
that was a huge role. Like, he's not
sure, but like, it, and then it's so, but I just mean, he hasn't been below that rate in a long time. And then it's 52, 46, 47.
He had 47 points last season with 5 power play points. So it's like, this guy can get his with or without the power play. He had 12 power play points the year before. This was the year where everyone wanted him run out of town. The Canucks can't give him away. And he ended up with 46 points. You okay?
I just accidentally kicked the button on my chair that, like, lowers the height.
Yeah.
And I, like, shot down. Like, it's like an amusement ride where they just, like, drop the bottom out from you. It was very shocking.
Did you feel?
But I'm okay.
Did you feel the earthquake last night?
I did not feel the earthquake. No, I slept soundly.
Okay. My dog woke me up because he had to go to the washroom, and like at just that moment, I felt the earthquake, and I was like, "Did you actually have to go to the bathroom, or did you
just sense an earthquake? That was
the earthquake
coming?
Was coming. You know what I mean?
Spooky.
Animals, man,
it's wild.
That very crazy.
All right, we'll take the over on Garland then. Hoglander, 37.5.
Ooh, that's high. That feels high to me.
Now, if you think he's going to play his way into a top six role, but a consistent top six role,
that's what you're betting. I don't want to bet projections. I'm not going to recommend you bet projections. I want you to bet floor. You know what I'm saying? Like, I want to bet floor cases, mm-hmm. right? That's why, like, JT Miller can smash 90.5. DeBrusque can smash 46.5. The guys who I'm picking under, I'm picking because it's like a base rate expectation, not relying on them hitting some outlier status. They're still going to have a shot to get there. Right. Those are the ones that I want if I'm betting overs and assuming the injury risk, you know, in a collision sport like hockey. Hoglander's never hit that. Like, you're literally counting on him having a breakout season above and beyond.
On top of his offensive breakout last year.
And on top of him shooting and converting on 20% of his shots last year.
Yeah.
So you're not betting base rate. The bet there is, does Hoglander become a top six fixture for this team? That's effectively the bet there. And I don't know that that's a bet I'd place confidently, even though I like his odds. Like, I personally will tell you, I think he's going to do it. I do. I believe he's going to do it. But I wouldn't want to lay money on it, given Heinen, Sherwood, Sprong, Lecker. Like, there's just so many sharks in the water here, all angling for those minutes. There's safer ways to place an even odds bet than betting on Nils Höglander to have a career high in points this year.
Last one, and I'll tell you right away, I like the under on this one. Danton Heinen at 40.5.
Ooh.
He has exceeded that once in his NHL career. Last year, it was 36 points in 74 games with the Boston Bruins. And again, is there a world where, hey, he finds really great chemistry next to JT Miller and Brock Besser, and he rides shotgun with them, and he, you know, finishes in the low to mid 40s? Yeah, absolutely. But as you were just describing, you're betting on a very specific role there for him.
Well, and you're betting on power play points because that's the other part of this. 40? You're talking 40? Like you're going to count on Danton Heinen having 45 on 5 points, like 6 more than Jake DeBrusk has ever had in any season of his career? Because what's the 47 point season he had as a first full time, full year in his first full NHL season, the key there, 12 power play points.
Yeah.
His, you know, he's never had more than 7 since. Like, not that Heinen's not going to have a role on PP2, but a role on PP2 is worth like 4 or 5 points in this city, mm-hmm. With how frequently power play one operates and takes up 90 plus seconds. So yeah, no, that base rate on that suggests smash the under. In fact, ask the book for an alternate line and bet the under at 35.5.
All right, we'll wrap it up there. Sean Gentile from The Athletic will join us next here. Always fun to chat with Sean. We'll get his perspective on the Canucks, maybe talking about The Athletic player rankings as well. That's coming up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strantz here. This hour brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Let Kubota do your heavy lifting. Visit them online at dleamc.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of 5-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Canucks are practicing at UBC. I haven't seen any tweets. I don't know if our guy Batch is there, if he's selfishly taking a day off after driving out to Abbotsford last night, but we'll see. We'll see if we get any reports from the Canucks out of UBC.
I did see one from Jeff Patterson, my friend and yours. Just that Miller, Pettersson, Hughes, Hronek, DeBrusk, Garland, Myers, Hoglander, Heinen among the Canucks headliners in this group, he tweeted. So that's something I only wanted to bring it up because I have seen some tinfoil hat wearing Canucks fans speculate about JT Miller. Yeah. Not like, what's the simpler thing, that the organization promoted a game with a player incorrectly inserted into the graphic, or that the club is hiding an injury for a player who's been practicing completely unencumbered and whose usage in preseason we were explicitly told would be limited a week ago? Like, what's more likely to you, Jamie?
Yeah. All right. Now joining us from The Athletic here on Canucks Talk, he is our guy, Sean Gentile. What's going on, man?
I don't think that was a yes or no question you asked.
A rhetorical? It was rhetorical.
Also, this happens a lot where I'm trying to move on to the next like piece of administrative business. In this case, getting you on the show, our guest, rather than have you wait on the line endlessly. And so I'm just kind of like, I'm half paying attention to Drantz, but I'm also like, here's what I'm going to do as soon as he stops talking.
I've known Drantz for a long time. You know this. Like, I'm very used to just letting him go. It's a concept I'm familiar with.
It's like, when he's done whatever it is he's doing, then I'm going to get Gentile on the show. I'm like, I don't need to answer this question, whatever it is.
Let's start with the big topic. How are you enjoying the Justin Fields era?
It's been more fun to watch than I anticipated it being.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm ready to say that he's good, but he does a lot of things that good NFL quarterbacks do, if that makes sense. He's getting better each week. A lot of throws across the middle, lots of fitting the ball into some pretty tight windows. I think they're pretty psyched with how things are going with the quarterback in town, for sure.
I think people struggle with quarterbacks to identify the different levels that there are to being good or not good. You know what I mean? And so like Justin Fields and Daniel Jones have spent like the whole summer being called terrible. And it's like, no, those are functional low end starters in the NFL. And then you see like a Skylar Thompson, you know what I mean, in the game. And it's just like, guys, that's what a crummy quarterback looks like. Like, there is a material difference. There are levels between this.
I mean, I like everybody was watching the game when Tua got hurt, and then Skylar Thompson comes in, and you're like, wow, this dude looks like a slot receiver. And then he played quarterback like a slot receiver. So yeah, like it could always be worse. There's nothing wrong with having Geno Smith. There's nothing wrong with having Justin Fields. Like there's a middle class of NFL quarterbacks.
Whoa. Geno Smith's
teams need to accept.
Geno Smith is also levels above. Let's be real. Geno Smith rocks.
God, Geno Smith might be. I'll give him. He's top half. Are you pretty?
No. He's like
10 or 12.
He's like an above average starter, though, with his deep accuracy relative to what like guys like Fields and Dimes are. Anyway, we were talking about on the last segment, we were positing and partly in reaction to, you know, the Hughes 3B Fuhrer, which, of course, you were part of last year. And this year you've got him. Do you guys rank within the tiers? Like, is he actually behind Adam Fox?
I think, I obviously don't know, but I'm pretty sure it was alphabetical. I looked at all the tiers and I believe it was alphabetical.
I thought so too. So that's why I wanted to clarify.
They're listed alphabetically, but I'm comfortable saying to you guys and all of our friends who are listening that he's ahead of that he came in ahead of Adam Fox.
Yeah.
The question was whether there was more of a gap between McCarr and Hughes or Hughes and Fox.
Right.
That was sort of the question that we were asking. You know, the folks that we talked to and had audit the list. And I think where we landed was that there's a little bit more of a gap maybe between McCarr and Hughes than Hughes and Fox, but also that I think it's pretty safe to say that Hughes is running second out of those three guys pretty decisively too.
Right. So we were talking about it in the last segment. Like, obviously it was a huge breakout year for Quinn Hughes, one of, you know, seven defenders in the last 10 years to hit over 84 points in a season. And this year, you know, is there a chance that he can continue to break out and continue to sort of close that gap, especially with sort of the opportunity that maybe the Four Nations tournament presents to see them go up against one another head to head, not to mention the fact that the Canucks and the Avs are both expected to be in the mix in the Western Conference. Can you envision that scenario?
I think he can certainly keep closing the gap. I think there is stuff he can probably work on in his own. I think that's the next step for him, because for as good as McCarr is and for as productive as he is, and you know, he's a skater on par with Quinn and all that stuff. He's also, there's something about the way he plays in his own zone that people are more eager to sign off on. Like a lot of it,
it's the hitting
size.
It's the size.
It's,
yeah.
It's hitting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, I don't know, like nobody wants, do you guys want to see Quinn Hughes throwing the body on a regular basis? Like,
no.
All things considered, I wouldn't if I were you, but I think there probably is some, you know, some work he can do on entry defense and all that that could maybe close the gap. Right. Like, but I mean, I don't know. I love his game. I love where he's at. He was a blast to watch last year. And the fact that we're having this discussion, this like an honest discussion over, you know, how much of a gap, if any, there is between him and McCarr, you know, in 2024. I think the fact that that's even a pressure point, like when people do goofy stuff like we tried to do here, I think the fact that that's even going on is a major testament to, you know, not just how much he's improved, but how much meat there it still feels like is left on the bone with him.
Yeah, I mean, how young both guys still are too, right? And as Drant said, you know, maybe a chance to go against each other best on best here. Hopefully not the last time that will be the case. So lots to look forward to for both of those players. And, you know, elsewhere from a Canucks perspective in the player rankings at The Athletic, I've made this point a couple of times on air now, but Elias Pettersson is in this really interesting spot where, you know, typically, as I'm sure you're well aware, Canucks fans, you know, very high on their own players, as most fan bases are. And when they feel they're being disrespected by the national media or the American media
or Dom,
that tends to tick them off. Pettersson's in this weird situation where I think everybody outside of Vancouver is higher on him than a lot of fans here in Vancouver. You guys had him ranked pretty well. What's your concern level, or I guess lack of concern level, for Elias Pettersson coming into this season?
can we just say that like, if people have a problem with, like the same people who would say that we have Pettersson ranked too low or too high are the ones that are going to say that we had Miller ranked too low. So maybe we can just like add those two together and divide by two.
Average it.
What's the difference? Just agree to, and just agree to move on. I don't know.
No, never.
I think Pettersson, we're all left with the way he played in the in the playoffs, and I know that didn't, you know, not just the way he played, but also the way that he was played, you know, with the line mate situation and all that, where it seemed like, you know, Rick Tocchet was treating JT Miller like he was his number one center, and that counts for something. But I think, like, in terms of completeness and in terms of, you know, improved defensive play and just like the amount of production that he gives, I think he's right at home in that tier two level. Like it does feel like there's some untapped level of completeness with him, but also he's in the mix with a lot of other guys that aren't, you know, that are imperfect in one way or another. So I don't know. I don't think we were overly ambitious with him, but I do certainly get the vibe that, you know, that whether it's national folks or however you want to classify it, that, yeah, there's, we maybe got a little bit more time for him than a certain section of the fan base does.
With JT Miller, right, who comes in as your 57th overall player, tier three center, behind 16 other senators.
What a team they have this year. 16 definitely, guys definitely better than JT Miller. Wow.
JT Miller's come to Washington to really shake up the Senate. With what goes into the thought process there from the perspective of evaluating a guy who had a season so unlike some of what he's previously done, not only in terms of scoring, although, you know, there was that, he's had another 99 point season. I mean, we've seen Miller go nuke offensively, but the defensive side being so distinct from what we've seen previously in his career, does that make it a tough sort of eval as you tier these players?
It definitely does. Cause I think everyone, not just us, I think everyone needed to reassess how they feel about JT Miller last season. I think that's what his play dictated. I think, like, over the last, you know, season or season and a half, people, you know, it's a kind of forget what you know about JT Miller's situation, right? Because it just seems like the mix is a little bit different for him. It's still tough. The idea that, you know, I think he shot 19% last year. You know what I mean? And he's a great goal scorer, and he deserves tons and tons of credit for that. But I still think there's, you know, much as he's improved and much as he's changed his reputation, I still think there's concern over what he's going to bring if he's not shooting at a really, really high clip. And I think he paid for that.
So I know you guys haven't done your team by team projections just yet, so you don't have to spoil things too much, but just kind of from your individual perspective, coming off that really impressive season last year, taking the Oilers to game seven in the playoffs, what are your expectations for the Canucks going into this season?
I wonder if I have time to actually pull up the projections here so I can make it seem like I'm just like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe they're
maybe like 99.5 points around there.
Let's see here. How much can I spill? We'll say that they're single digits in point. They're top seven in point projection based on Dom's model. It doesn't necessarily mean they're seventh either. I like where they're at. I think I like their off season. I think I like Jake DeBrusk more than a lot of other people do. Maybe I think he's potentially a pretty good fit there. It's just about, you know, it's about depth up front, and it's about Demko getting healthy for me. Like I think as long as his rehab, you know, ends the right way relatively quickly, I think there's going to be a lot to be said for that team. And I think they're better now than they were than they were a year ago. So certainly projection wise, that's for sure. Right. Like the kind of year that they had, did for them. You know, you're coming into the preseason looking a lot better in the eyes of folks like Don Lestition and people who come up with the projections, right? Like they're sitting pretty. And I think that's for a reason. That's a talented team, that went out and got better this offseason as well.
Do you think they're better despite the loss of Lindholm and Zadorov? Because, you know, my sort of way of framing this has generally been, I don't know if they're better, but I don't think they got worse, which, given the Pettersson extension and the Hronek extension and their core getting more expensive, is probably a pretty neat trick. That's kind of been my framing here. Gentile, do you just not expect the sort of Lindholm and Zadorov departures to register?
I agree with you. And you also wrote something at some point during the offseason kind of outlining that whole idea. And I think I've cribbed from that to some extent. I mean, I do agree with you. I think, you know, this offseason could have been a catastrophe, I think, in a lot of ways for Rutherford and Alvin, and it wasn't. And I think they deserve credit for what they did, like what they did with Hronek. I mean, I know whatever. We don't need to relitigate, you know, the merits of Philip Hronek, but like we can say that he looks like an ideal partner for Quinn Hughes, right? So just lock the dude up, make that the priority, and if you handle that type of business, you know, the truly in-house stuff, the must-have guys in terms of the core moving forward, I think it certainly cushions the blow when you're talking about losing the Lindholm and Zadorovs of the world, because ultimately they made more money than Vancouver could have or should have paid them, right? Like those are contracts that just wouldn't and couldn't and shouldn't have worked with that team that they signed in Boston. So yeah, on that level, I think the offseason was a success, and I think it starts with, you know, some of the extensions that they got done.
You've hit on something that, you know, I wouldn't say it like keeps me up at night, because obviously I'm too unbiased for that. But
yeah,
I've spent most of the last 10 years as an analyst betting against the Boston Bruins, and I've been and I've been wrong every single year. As they defy gravity, there's something about the Canucks positioning this offseason where it's like effectively they've bet in real terms against the Boston Bruins, right? Forbert, Heinen, DeBrusk in Vancouver, Lindholm, Zadorov to Boston. I feel like that's an uncomfortable spot to be.
Man, I haven't even thought of that. Yeah, they're assuming that Boston's making the wrong decisions. You know, the wrong guys and also signing the wrong guys. Yeah, man,
the Canucks are the battle. Fancy stats guy being like, this is the year the Bruins regress, and it's like I've had that bar conversation. I don't believe you.
Right, and the Bruins are like, hey, our average weight is up to 225 pounds per player. Like, we win.
Yeah. Does that give you pause?
Oh God, you're so right, because I thought we all thought the true fall off was happening with Boston last year for a million different reasons, and it just hasn't. And even still, I look at their depth chart and I'm like, yeah, Lindholm's fine. He seems like he's a good match with Pasternak. Like, we know that if nothing else, that dude has a fairly decent track record of being productive along truly elite players. Like I get it. They needed a center. But also I'm like, it just feels like they still kind of feels like they need another one. they need Poitras to pop, or like they need someone other than, you know, than Charlie Coyle and Morgan Geeky and whatever else. They need like one other dude. And so as I'm looking at their depth chart, I'm like, do I not, I don't believe in the Boston Bruins again. Like I'm about to fall in the same trap. I'm about to think that they're, that the fall off is happening for them. And it clearly just for one reason or another, man, whether it's defensive structure, Jim Montgomery or whatever's going on, it seems like a foolish bet to make, but also I'm compelled to make it all the same.
I think the counter to the idea of being wary of the Canucks betting against the Bruins is, one, I mean, both teams, there's a world where both teams can be successful, right? It's not as if both teams, one has to fail for the other one to succeed. But I also, like, when I look at the history of the Bruins avoiding that fall off, so much of it is about, you know, first Bergeron and Krejci, now Pastrnak, Marchand, Charlie McAvoy. Like, it's about that core of talent more than it is them making like ruthless free agency decisions necessarily. You know what I mean? So I don't know that it's like, oh, you can't bet against their player evaluation as much as you can't bet against their core of talent.
I think there's a level of pragmatism involved with the decisions that they made too. Like, the fact of the matter is, like, Elias Lindholm is a better fit given each team's needs for the Boston Bruins, mm-hmm. and Jake DeBrusk, given each team's needs, is a better fit for the Vancouver Canucks, and on and on. You can go down the list, right? So I don't know if we need to pit it as like an either or A versus B thing. I think that both teams rated the other and probably got better for it. That's kind of the way. That's the way I land on it, I suppose.
My problem is every year I'm like, Connor Clifton loved his work. And then he goes elsewhere, and I'm like, Connor Clifton, product of the Bruins system. And like, you're saying it's about the core. No, it's that the Bruins go out and get guys who I legitimately think cap out as third line players. And then the next thing I know, they're 50-point centermen. Like, Pavel Zacha is a 50-point centerman now. Like, what are we doing here?
It's the Pavel Zacha and Charlie Coyle.
Yeah, it's black magic. Right? Like, it's pure black magic. I'm sorry. There is no rational explanation.
Well, no, it's David Pastrnak. He's wicked. That's a huge part of it, why they're able to put guys with him and they blow up in terms of point production, right?
I mean, partly, but it's also just like, no, like, how do you explain, like, okay.
No.
How do you explain Tuukka Rask, the most successful goaltender of the like post Lundqvist Luongo era, in terms he like leaves, I'm like, oh, they're finally hooped. They sign Linus Ullmark. I'm like, oh baby, oh, give me all the Bruins to fade shares in the world. And then it's like Linus Ullmark rocks, and now he's gone to Ottawa and he's going to be terrible. And Jonas Korpisalo is going to be amazing because that's how this works.
Isn't this like the ultimate test of the principle? Like, whatever happened with Ullmark and whatever happened with Korpisalo?
Yes.
Like, we can track those two dudes over the course of this season and make like final decisions.
Well, yep, okay. And like the most extreme example of switching locations, right? Like the ultimate spot for a goalie in Boston versus like one of the worst spots for a goalie in Ottawa that they're switching places between.
Yeah, like there's a very real chance that Linus Ullmark goes to Ottawa and is like, wait a second, I'm not a one shot goaltender anymore. Like, I have to deal with rebounds and stuff. Like, uh-oh. And then he ends up reverting back to Buffalo mode, right? I think that's very possible. I don't know if it's probable that we're gonna be able to track it, right? Because you got the body switch going on with him and Korpisalo. It's very, very interesting.
I'm just scared of Bruins black magic. It's really that simple.
I mean, you guys have been burned before.
That's true.
No kidding.
Before we let you go, can we get a Penguins vibe check from you, Sean?
Oof.
It's a good start.
Probably not great. I think Rutger McGroarty is going to start the season in the AHL, which, you know, as their big prospect addition, you know, with that trade they made with Winnipeg, you know, that seems like that's where that's tracking for him. So this is a team that's not going to look all that much different. You're talking about, you know, a little bit of a remade bottom six where they added the Blake Lizotts of the world and, you know, on and on. Like they shuffled around the pieces at the bottom, but I don't know how much anything's going to change. Like, the only thing that matters for them is getting the power play in some kind of workable state, which it basically wasn't at any point last year. They were, I think, 31st in goals per 60 with a man advantage last year. And, you know, when you miss the playoffs by 3 points or whatever it is, like, it's a pretty glaring stat. So if they fix that, they'll probably be on the edge of the mix. And if they don't, you know, we're looking at a, you know, 83 point team or something.
Sean, great to have you back on the show, man. We appreciate it as always. Looking forward to chatting again soon.
Yeah, man, this is like the official season kickoff for me.
That's right. When we come crawling back to you, and you know hockey is coming back.
It's a signal like unlike any other.
Thanks, buddy.
You're the best.
All right.
That is Sean Gentile from The Athletic joining us here and weighing in on some of the individual player rankings for the Canucks and giving us just a little sneak
Bruins
preview.
Black magic. I'm serious. It's like niggling in the back of my brain. I can't shake that like concern. It's the least rational hockey thought I have.
I guess my thing is like Lindholm and Zadorov could go there and be great, and that doesn't actually impact the Canucks season.
No, but
are you're more concerned about like guys who were good in Boston going elsewhere?
I'm concerned about all of it. You're saying it doesn't matter if Zadorov goes to Boston and it's like the Zadorov McAvoy pair are getting like Hughes Hronek type results. That of course that matters.
No, but it doesn't affect the Canucks. It might affect how we look at that decision, but it doesn't mean like, and therefore they'll have a bad season.
No, but that would mean presumably that the Canucks then are missing Zadorov an awful lot more than we think, right? That like some of what we saw in the playoffs, some of that secondary puck moving, you know, and vice versa, right? The guys that the Canucks brought in, you get like some Connor Clifton-itis out of that. You know what I mean? Look, in the back of my brain, Bruins black magic. I don't understand it. It never makes sense to me, but it's pretty well demonstrated over the last, especially the last 5-6 years. I don't know how, but that team doesn't miss.
Introducing Seeker, Canada's new free app for your ears. Dive into live radio, captivating podcasts, the latest news and sports updates all in one place. Whether you're rediscovering music, debating last night's game, or laughing along with your favorite DJs, Seeker has you covered. Plus, there are some of the best prizes in the country up for grabs. It's all here in one easy-to-use app. Download Seeker for free from the App Store or Google Play. Seeker, seek your sounds, find the radio, podcast, news, and sports you love. Final segment next with Gemma Karsten-Smith here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance here live from the Kintec Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome. Details at DunbarLumber.com. Final segment of the show here, and now joining us on the line from the Canadian Press covering the Canucks and more in the Vancouver sports scene, she is Gemma Karsten-Smith. Gemma, thank you as always. Nice to have you back on the show. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you guys?
We're doing great. Drance yesterday was like going on and on about how much he loves the show and how happy he is to be back. It was unnerving.
It's very strange when Drance is like earnest and positive at the same time. It's very confusing.
Guys, I'm always earnest and positive. I'm a ray of sunshine.
You are a bright, shining light.
Thanks, Gemma.
Of some sort, yes.
Of black light.
So, Gemma, I think one of the big storylines, it's fair to say, through Canucks training camp and now into the preseason is the kind of the battle for top six forward spots, right? And, you know, we've got probably four guys locked in there, Miller, Besser, Pettersson, DeBrusk, and then the fight to claim those other two spots is, I don't think we have a lot of clarity on it right now. You've got some veterans. You've got a young player like Jonathan Lekkerimäki trying to do it. How would you six opportunities right now for the Canucks?
Well, I'm out here at UBC right now. We just watched most of practice. I'm missing a veil to talk to you guys, so thanks for that. Just kidding. But we saw Danton Heinen lining up with JT and Brock again today. So I think that we'll probably see that line on the ice tomorrow in Seattle. Tomorrow, Seattle, right?
Yeah.
So I think that that's something that they want to get an in-game look at. I thought that Lekkerimäki did relatively well in his showings thus far, but I think he's still so young and so raw that it's unlikely he'll be up with the big club to start the season. Hopefully he'll get a look down the road, but he's just, he's still a young man, right? And he looks like a young man. He's got some growing to do both on the ice and in the weight room. So I don't think that he's going to be up there just yet. He's got more work to do. As for the other guys, I think we'll see. There's a lot of new faces around this team, and where they slot into different roles really does remain to be seen.
Gemma, when you consider Vancouver's forward options and you consider what we saw out of Daniel Sprong last night, I mean, do they have enough skill in terms of some of their supporting pieces for him to not play up lineup?
Yeah, I think that that's a huge question. But if he plays up the lineup, do you trust him enough defensively? This is the double-edged sword that the Canucks are walking right now. So it's, I think he'll definitely get a chance. Whether or not he sticks is kind of up to him, and whether he's ready to make that leap on the defensive side and play that full 200-foot game that has got him in a little bit of trouble in past assignments. But he's obviously, that skill that he possesses is incredible and would do nothing but add to Vancouver's lineup. So they want him up there, I'm sure. It's just if they can trust him to stick up there on a long-term basis.
So we know that there's, you know, the training camp battles, preseason's going on. That'll occupy a lot of our focus. But since it's our first time having you on the show this year, I figured maybe we could zoom out and I'd ask you, like, what are some of the big picture storylines that you're most interested in tracking over the course of the season?
I'm very interested to see how the power play does because I think it was such a point of not contention last year, but disappointment almost. Mm-hmm. You have so much skill and that's what you're producing, really? So I think how do you get more out of that power play with those players is a big one. Like we were talking about, I think that where some of these new faces fit into the lineup is going to be really intriguing. I'm interested to see where Keefer Sherwood ends up. I'm interested to see how Vinny Desharnais finds a role in the top six, or is he that kind of floater? I don't know. I think, again, it depends a lot on what more they can get out of them. The Canucks have made a lot of signings around the edges over the course of the offseason, DeBrusk notwithstanding, obviously. But to see whether they can squeeze that little extra out of those signings and find that value added. I think that that's what they're trying to do. They're going to try and see how many more Dakota Joshuas they can find around the league to fit in those perimeter roles. So I'm intrigued to see how that plays out this year. It feels like there's more optimism around this team than there has been in my 7 or 8 years of covering them. I don't think there's been this much optimism come preseason in the past. And I'm really intrigued to see how that plays out.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing, right? Coming into a season with expectations and with other teams around the league kind of circling you on the schedule as a game against a team to beat. On the power play, Gemma, I mean, I think it's a really good point, right? And, you know, even we were kind of going through earlier, like, point totals, betting point totals for players, and, you know, will Pettersson clear 90 points? And so much of it depends on, can they get the power play running like you feel it should be able to run with that much talent? And, you know, we know it's going to be the same four guys, right? Pettersson, Miller, Besser, Hughes featuring, then maybe DeBrusk, maybe Sprong, but basically the same personnel. And, you know, it's interesting because last year under Tocchet, right, they took so many strides defensively and they executed his game plan so well. And it feels like the one area where they weren't able to kind of put into practice what he was preaching was the power play, because he was so often stressing, you know, we don't have to run plays. It's about attacking with pressure. Why don't you think they were able to take what Tocchet was preaching about the power play and turn it into on-ice success consistently last year?
When that power play was successful last year, they were being creative. When they got stale is when they went to hockey robotism. When it was just that passing, looking for the open lane, not using the skill that is there, because that's what's special. What's special is the hockey minds and how they think the game. So their ability to make all those moves is great. But if you don't have that creativity, it doesn't mean a whole lot. These guys need to be able to use that creativity to unlock their skills and reach another level. And that is what this power play needs. So they need to be able to be a little bit more free-flowing, create a lot of movement, and not fall into the robotics that we saw last year.
Gemma,
there's music starting up in the background here at UBC.
Gemma, in terms of this core group, right, there was so many spectacular, like, next level performances, whether it was, you know, what we saw out of JT Miller as a defensive player, you know, goes without saying what Quinn Hughes and Brock Besser were able to accomplish. What does a successful follow-up look like for sort of the five or six best players on this Canucks team?
Totally. I think it's less about point totals and more about maintaining their overall game, because I think that's what's made so many of these guys successful is that full being able to play both ends of the ice, being able to lead, being able to execute night in, night out. So being able to maintain that on a year-to-year basis instead of just a game-to-game basis, I think that's the big one. Because so much of last season was watching this team build confidence and build chemistry. And if they can do that again, I think they're in a real good position. Just because of where this team sits in terms of the division they're in, I think that if they can maintain what they had last year, they'll just grow naturally a little bit. And that's all they need to do, right? They only need to grow a little bit in order to secure a playoff spot, and then the new thing can happen. So I think it's just about staying healthy and maintaining in order to move forward here.
And of course, one of the other big storylines all season is going to be the goaltending situation. And, you know, part of that is, of course, a huge part of that is Demko's health, when he gets back, how he looks, how they manage his workload. But, you know, until that happens, part of that is what they do in net with Archer Shelovs and Kevin Lankinen. And, you know, I believe it was you after the game on Monday who asked Rick Tocchet about just that demeanor, that calmness that Shelov seems to have. And just how important you think that mentality for Shelovs is going to be, right? Like, we saw it in the playoffs last year, now potentially going into the season as the team's starting goalie at such a young age. How valuable is it for the Canucks that Shelovs seems to be able to just roll with the punches no matter what happens?
It is honestly astounding. I cannot understand this kid, because he is cool as a cucumber, as my four-year-old would say. He just, nothing fazes him. You want to throw me in from, make me the starter in the playoffs? Go for it. You want to make me your starter to start the season? Okay. Like, it's not even that he's scared or nervous, because that would be expected, but he doesn't seem excited either. That is what gets him. It's just like, yep, this is just my life. It just astounds me. But I think that's huge. I think that what I was saying about maintaining and using that to grow, I think that his calm demeanor and that calm energy is just so key for that. If he isn't rattled, people around him aren't going to get that rattle either, right? So if he's unfazed, I think it's a real good sign. And as soon as we start to see him get rattled, that's when there will be warning bells.
That said, how do you, like, this is something I'm just wrestling with. How do I wait what to expect from Canucks goaltending this year? Like, I just have no idea. How are you thinking about that going into the season?
Oh, man, I don't think you can wait anything right now until we have more information, right? Like, until you know what's happening in terms of Demko's timeline, you can't. There's just a vacuum. You don't know how to wait the goaltending, because you just don't know what the goaltending is going to be. I think Shelovs is good. He's a good goaltender, absolutely. But he's also 23 years old. He's played, what, 9 regular season NHL games? Mm-hmm. That's not a record that you can build any sort of prediction off of. And until you know what's happening with Dembo, like, you can't build any sort of prediction off of that either. So I think there's just, it's a wait-and-see approach, and that's not really what you want heading into the season, but what's the other option at this point?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's why Kevin Lankinen was so important, right? I mean, not that he's going to be a world beater for you, but at least you have, you're not all of a sudden going into the season with a Shelovs Patera duo, right? Where they have like 20 regular season games in the NHL between them, or less than 20. At least you have somebody with that little bit of experience that should be able to give you that baseline experience until or baseline performance until Demko is healthy.
Exactly. It's again, that steady presence, that calm. And I don't know Langdon as a person, so I can't speak to his demeanor, but like, that's what they need. They need someone steady who knows, who's been there before. Because Shelov can be as cool as a cucumber, but that trust won't fully be there because he's only played 9 NHL regular season games.
All right, Gemma, I'll put you on the spot here before we let you go. Give us a bold hot take for the Canucks season. Oh. Something that we can clip and then use to make fun of you when it doesn't come true later in the season.
Freezing cold hot take?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm gonna say Pettersson hits 100.
Let's go. So you're not buying the Pettersson doomerism cycle here.
No. I think he's full throttle ahead. I think he's taking all that negativity and turning it into jet fuel.
That's a fantastic way to put it. I love it, Gemma. We will clip that. We'll check back in at the end of the season to see if we're making fun of you or if we're lauding you for your foresight on calling.
We would never make fun of you, Gemma.
I'm sure that you can do both.
Why not? Why wouldn't we?
I would.
Friendly teasing. It's all right.
No. I'd only make fun of you with Gemma.
Okay, sure.
Oh, thanks, guys. Thanks.
Okay. Gemma, appreciate it, man. We'll talk again soon.
Bye, guys. Have a great day.
That is Gemma Carson-Smith from the Canadian Press. Elias Pettersson taking the negativity and turning it in to jet fuel. Gemma also not buying the Elias Pettersson was invisible in Abbotsford.
Is that a thing?
Come on, man. You know this city well enough.
People are just looking for something to complain about.
As I said, you know this city well enough, of course.
A star's preseason form is like absolutely not worth shedding a single word about.
Final few minutes here. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. It is Canucks talk. And as you pointed out, Jeff Patterson also out at UBC. And as Gemma said there, Danton Heinen was skating with JT Miller and Brock Besser. Elias Pettersson, Jake DeBrusch joined by Kiefer Sherwood on their right wing at the skate. We don't have the full lines, but we're not sure who was in what group, right? But nice opportunity for Kiefer Sherwood to be up with Elias Pettersson and Jake DeBrusch. Quinn Hughes and Philip Hronek reunited, so maybe that's signaling where we're going for the rest of the preseason and into the regular season. Kudryavtsev and Myers and Forbort and Juulsen, the other defensive pairings that we had from Jeff Patterson out at UBC. So not a ton to dig into there, but, you know, with Kiefer Sherwood going up to play with Jake DeBrusch and Elias Pettersson, I know he was a standout for a lot of people who watched the game last night. I mean, his speed really leaps off the screen. I know Sat, we were doing the post-game show, he's very, very high on the potential upside for Kiefer Sherwood. What do you think about, you know, he doesn't really factor into these conversations that we're having about, okay, who can claim a spot higher up in the lineup because there's just so much competition for those. But are you buying on the idea that there might be some more offensive upside to tap in Kiefer Sherwood's game?
Yeah, I mean, there's some evidence of it based on what he's done at the American League level.
He had one monster season, goal-scoring season at the AHL level,
Yeah, I mean, he's been a point-per-game guy in the A, you know, sort of dating back to kind of when he became like 25, right? Like, it took him a year or two out of university and then pretty quickly was an elite American League scorer. I just don't think it matters in some ways. Like, I don't think it matters if Kiefer Sherwood can play in the top six. I think what matters is, can he bring what this team just didn't get consistently enough from Sam Lafferty in terms of that meanness, in terms of that identity stuff, in terms of mixing it up and being a factor on the fourth line. For me, I think that's what I'm looking for. You know,
I agree with you to an extent, but I don't like it. To me, it's not about can he play in the top six, but even in a bottom six role, one of the things this team has to do to offset, or one of the things this team can do to offset some of the offensive regression from guys in the top six, is get more production from the bottom six, right? So I think there has to...
I mean, they got so much last year. They just need to continue to get some.
Right. But like with Sam Lafferty, it was all... You could always tell, like, these are bounces that are going in and they're going to stop. And then they stopped, right?
I don't know, man. We could always tell. There was so much great... Like, no one said the word Sam Lafferty without adding great trade. For months, he went, remember, he went like he'd scored like one goal in 32 games and then he scores and people were still doing the like, thank you, Maple Leafs. It's like, guys, I think they're fine. Like, I don't think that matters at all.
But my point is that I don't think it's just about bringing that grit element. Like, I think you want to see that offense production from the bottom six. And I think Kiefer Sherwood should be a part of that.
Well, yeah, he will be. Like, he's got 17 goals in his last 90 NHL games, right? So that's like, you know, 15-ish per 82. He generated a giant mess of scoring chances in that playoff series against the Vancouver Canucks. Mm-hmm. Like, if the Canucks had forgotten their horseshoes for any of those games, he probably would have had like 3 or 4 points in the series. He's a good finisher. He's a fast skater. He's going to be a useful, like, against the grain attacker. He fits into what this team wants to do off the rush. But, you know, I just fundamentally sort of think about this bottom six mix. And what I don't want to see a lot of are the cardio king guys. Mm-hmm. Right now, look, this mattered. Like, the Phil DiGiuseppe, Anthony Beauvillier, Sam Lafferty, sort of Nils Amon tier of take up a lot of space, skate fast, back check hard. Like, those guys played Rick Tocchet hockey. It was a big factor in how this team defended, was just having like long guys who skate back. It's just that a lot of the Canucks' long guys who skate back also, you know, weren't threats to score or weren't threats to mix it up or face wash a guy or just like change up the momentum of the game in sort of a different way. The Canucks should. I mean, if you're looking at, even if you're starting with like a Sprong, Suter, Sherwood fourth line and a Hoglander, Bluger, Garland third line, it's like, okay, well, Sprong's, you know, something of a DH offensively and can punch up the power play and do a ton of stuff. Suter, we know, is jack of all trades, play wherever you want. Like, all of those guys bring something. And then obviously when Dakota Joshua comes back, you know, you've got a pretty unique physical player there too. I like that, but it only works, in my view anyway, if Sherwood sort of stirs the drink.
If you have someone bringing that kind of more classic bottom six element,
just some mean, irascible energy. That's what I want from Sherwood. And do I think he has the upside to play up lineup? I do. I think there's a chance that you can create, could you create a $4.5 million two-way winger in the aggregate between Sprong and Sherwood?
And Sherwood, yeah.
I mean, that's sort of how I look at it.
Or could you just create a fourth line that has significantly more scoring punch than a lot of fourth lines, right? Like, if you're talking Suter, Sprong, Sherwood on the fourth line, right? Like, that's pretty interesting. Yeah. those guys can do some things. As you said, they're not just out there, hey, skate fast and then come back to the bench in 30 seconds right after you skated fast.
It's important to me, I think, and important to the bottom six, that you don't have just like a lot of the same guy, and that same guy isn't just like skating kilometers out there. You know, which I felt like there were too many minutes like that for the Canucks last year. And I think it's one of the reasons they didn't generate enough. I feel like they should have the personnel to have a different mix. But this year, to have guys who bring something unique to the table on a shift by shift basis. But the one thing I look up and down this lineup, and especially until Joshua comes back, really think they need is I do think they need a presence to up. And Sherwood, to me, like, he has to do that. That, for me, everything starts there. You know, what upside, what else he can do, all has to take a back seat to bringing that identity.
He's got to do that at a baseline, or else he could be out of the lineup if he's not bringing that. Right.
I don't even think it's about that. It's just that this team needs someone to do it.
Yeah. All right. We'll wrap it up there. Thanks to everyone for texting in. Thanks to our guests for joining us as well. Another Canucks preseason game day tomorrow for our Friday edition of our show. So we will be back on at noon. I think it's Blair and Barker next. And then Josh has the People Show coming up at 3.
Are you just guessing? Like, I think it's,
I don't know, man. I don't want to say around here. It changes like minute to minute. I don't want to say anything with absolute certainty. Are you kidding me? But that's what Josh told me.
Are you saying we're day by day?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
That's what Josh told me in the prep room. So blame him if I'm wrong. Anyways, we'll be back tomorrow at noon for more Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.